Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to update some information about the assassination of Martin Luther King. That is a program, that's a subject, I should say, covered in numerous broadcasts, including RFA 8, the Orders to Kill series, and also the Guns of November Part 4, all of those available from Spitfire. We're going to begin by reviewing a very significant development with regard to the assassination of Martin Luther King. This was presented in a half-hour segment updating America's various political assassinations. It was recorded in August of 1998, and after listening to this update, we're going to update the update, I guess one could say. Now, as I speak in August of 1998, the accused assassin of Martin Luther King, James Earl Ray, passed away this past April. As anyone who has readily studied, or as anyone who has studied the assassination of Martin Luther King knows, James Earl Ray was framed. He did not kill Martin Luther King any more than Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy or Saran Saran killed Robert Kennedy. James Earl Ray was framed. You can find that out. There's good discussion of that in RFA program number 8 about the assassination of Martin Luther King, and also a 7-part series about the book Orders to Kill by William Pepper in 1995. Both of those programs or series are available from Spitfire. As I discussed in the Guns of November Part 4 about the assassination of President Kennedy, and as I took up again in RFA programs 11, 12, and 13, and again all of those tapes are available from Spitfire, there are numerous evidentiary tributaries connecting America's various political assassinations. And in the immediate aftermath of James Earl Ray's death, yet another of those apparent connections emerged. The following article is from the San Francisco Examiner of April 27, 1998. This is an article by Douglas Holt, H-O-L-T, of the Chicago Tribune. It's Dateline Chicago and headlined, Ray Papers Fodder for Conspiracy Theorists, and this discusses some documentation produced by a former FBI agent, which would appear to connect the milieu of Jack Ruby, the organized crime figure who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy for the Kennedy assassination, with James Earl Ray, the patsy in the Martin Luther King assassination. This article, again, from the San Francisco Examiner of April 27, 1998, reads in part as follows. Sheathed in plastic, the yellowed, ink-stained slips of paper sit in a North Suburban bank vault. Their owner, former FBI agent Donald G. Wilson, 55, stepped forward last month saying the papers came from the car of James Earl Ray, the confessed killer of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Ray died of liver failure Thursday. Wilson, who now runs Andon Music Performance Corporation in Buffalo Grove, Illinois, said he found the papers in Atlanta in Ray's abandoned car days after King's 1968 assassination in Memphis. He said he concealed them out of fear he would be punished for disturbing a crime scene. After Ray confessed, Wilson said, he figured the case was closed. But when he saw Coretta Scott King on television last year pleading for information to spur a trial for Ray, Wilson said, he called the Kings to reveal what he says he found. Quote, the King family wants to know the truth, unquote, Wilson said. I thought I might be able to help, unquote. The papers bear the handwritten name Raoul, the name of a supposed gunrunner Ray blamed for a plot to kill King. And they include a telephone number that once rang a Dallas nightclub owned by Jack Ruby, the man who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, President John F. Kennedy's assassin. These last couple of sentences again, because they are portentous. The papers bear the handwritten name Raoul, the name of a supposed gunrunner Ray blamed for a plot to kill King. And they include a telephone number that once rang a Dallas nightclub owned by Jack Ruby, the man who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, President John F. Kennedy's assassin. If authentic, they suggest a link between the assassinations of King and Kennedy. If not, as the FBI insists, they illustrate how far conspiracy theorists will go to perpetuate a hoax. But I think, in addition to the fact that there are numerous evidentiary tributaries connecting the Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy assassinations, as discussed in The Guns of November Part 4, available from Spitfire, I think that this journalistic slighting here of former Agent Wilson is sadly only too typical of the way our political assassinations have been handled. There's no reason to cast aspersions on this man's integrity. And indeed, there are numerous evidentiary tributaries between the John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations, as discussed in RFA number 4. Arthur Haynes, James Earl Ray's first attorney, had been involved with the Bay of Pigs as a CIA contract agent, also connected to the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. Yet another incident which provides an evidentiary tributary between the Kennedy and King assassinations, as discussed in the Miltier documents. Percy Forman was an attorney for Jack Ruby and James Earl Ray. There are other connecting links between the two assassinations as well, such as Carlos Marcello, the former capo mafioso for New Orleans. And again, some of these are discussed in the Guns of November Part 4 and the Orders to Kill series. That again from an update on America's political assassinations from August of 1998. What we're going to do now is to update the update, I guess one could say. By the way, I misspoke myself at one point during that excerpt. I identified the archive show talking about connections between the Kennedy assassination and other political assassinations as RFA 4. It was the Guns of November Part 4, not RFA 4. Updating the information about former FBI agent Donald Wilson's documents, which, among other things, not only confirm the Raoul information, or tend to confirm the Raoul information, but which also link the milieu of the Martin Luther King assassination with Jack Ruby, we find the following. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, January 19th of 1999. Following article is from the National Report section. It is from the Chronicle News Services. It's Dateline Washington, and it reads as follows. Raoul documents in Kingslaying pass one test. That's the headline and the text. A scientific test has failed to discredit two documents a former FBI agent said he took from James Earl Ray's car in 1968 after the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr., but the failure does not prove the documents are authentic or that they clear Ray in the murder, a federal official said yesterday. The former agent, Donald Wilson, came forward last March with the two documents, which he said he had kept hidden for 30 years after the civil rights leader's assassination. An FBI spokesman at that time called them fabrications. Wilson's documents both have the name Raoul written on them. Ray, who died in prison in April at age 70 from liver disease, claimed after he was sentenced that he had been set up by a smuggler he knew only as Raoul. Ray pleaded guilty in 1969 to the King assassination in exchange for a 99-year sentence, but recanted within days and tried unsuccessfully for the rest of his life to obtain a trial. The King family supported his efforts. Quote, "The tests can't establish authenticity, but they can determine if a document is bogus in certain ways. One test failed to show the documents were bogus," unquote, said a federal official who requested anonymity. Other tests are planned, this official said. Quote, "Investigators will still have doubts about them," unquote. Although the test results fall short of confirming the document's validity, Wilson told the Atlantic Journal-Constitution, which first reported the results, that he believed the test was, quote, "a very positive development," unquote. Indeed, although I think we can expect officialdom in this country to continue to try to cast aspersions on former Agent Wilson and also his documentation. There's an article which not only updates the information about the Wilson documents, but which also updates the investigation into the assassination of Martin Luther King, which has been proceeding haltingly forward, even despite James Earl Ray's death. There was a very, it's a good article by one of the very best writers on America's political assassinations, Dick Russell, the author of the book The Man Who Knew Too Much, arguably the best and certainly the longest book about the assassination of President Kennedy. Dick Russell has written an article updating information about the investigation into the Martin Luther King assassination. This article was carried, oddly enough, in High Times Magazine's issue of March of 1999. High Times is a marijuana advocacy publication, and although I do not hold a brief for its main subject material, High Times has been publishing some very, very good investigative articles over the years, and I think it says a lot about the state of American investigative journalism that some of the best information about some of our political assassinations in recent years has been published by a marijuana advocacy magazine. That's not to pass judgment on marijuana smokers, but I think it does say a lot about the sorry state of American investigative journalism. However, the High Times issue of March of 1999 has a very good article by Dick Russell entitled A King-Sized Conspiracy. The article is subheaded, "The judge investigating the 30-year-old assassination of Martin Luther King turned up so much evidence of government complicity and cover-up that he's been yanked off the case." And you won't hear about that in any other publication in America. The article reads, 30 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the public is being led to believe that the case is definitely closed. James Earl Ray, the alleged killer, died at age 70 last year of liver and kidney failure while imprisoned for the crime. A new book by Gerald Posner, Killing the Dream, concludes that Ray indeed acted alone. A report issued last March by the Memphis District Attorney General's office calls the evidence against Ray, quote, overwhelming, unquote. All this is being trumpeted by the major media as the last word, despite the King family's call for a federal commission to examine new evidence which they feel would establish a conspiracy and prove that Ray was a dupe. Those same media did not see fit to cover a two-day conference on the assassination held in Memphis over the weekend of the 30th anniversary of April 4, 1968. The remarks of Judge Joe Brown, among others, were not reported in the press or over the airwaves. Judge Brown, a 50-year-old African-American first elected to Memphis's criminal court bench in 1990, had been routinely assigned in 1994 to review an effort by James Earl Ray's attorney, William Pepper, to seek a new trial. Then, in March of 98, the Tennessee Court of Appeals granted the state's motion to have Brown removed from the proceedings for having, they deemed, demonstrated the appearance of bias, unquote. So Judge Brown decided to speak out publicly for the first time about the shenanigans that resulted in his ouster and about the physical evidence proving that Ray could not have been the perpetrator. The judge, it turns out, is a longtime avid hunter and firearms expert. Ray had supposedly fired a single bullet downward from a rooming house window, striking King as he stood on the Lorraine Motel balcony 207 feet away. The supposed murder weapon, a Remington .30-06 rifle, was found on a public street after the shooting, bearing Ray's fingerprints, though none of his fingerprints were ever found in the rooming house itself. When Judge Brown ordered a test firing of the rifle in 1997, the results proved, quote, inconclusive, unquote. When he called for a second firing, he was taken off the case. As Brown puts it, quote, what you've got in terms of the physical evidence relative to ballistics is frightening. First, it's not the right type of rifle. It's never been sighted in. It's the wrong kind of scope, unquote. And furthermore, again quoting, with a .30-06, it makes a particularly difficult shot firing at a downward trajectory in that circumstance, unquote. Bear in mind that Judge Brown is an avid hunter and firearms enthusiast. Continuing. Above all, according to Brown, metallurgical analysis excludes the bullet taken from the body of Dr. King from coming from the cartridge case they say was fired in that rifle. The bullet was originally sent to the FBI lab intact. What came back was fragments, but there was a piece of the intact bullet In the last 4 years, that photograph, which was marked into evidence, is missing. A number of items were removed from this case. There was one incident where Brown's own court had to send one of its bailiffs to physically stop an individual from removing the bullet fragments from the courthouse, unquote. The actual sniper seems to have fired from behind some tall shrubs facing the second-floor motel balcony. Wayne Chastain, then a Memphis newspaper reporter, had arrived at the scene within 10 minutes. He was told by two witnesses, King's chauffeur and a lawyer, that the shot came from those bushes. By the next morning, according to the Reverend James Orange, an associate of King's in Memphis, quote, the bushes were gone. The authorities were said to be cleaning up the area, unquote. Across the street from the Lorraine Motel at the time sat Jim's Grill, owned by Lloyd Jowers, quote, if he is permitted to come forward, unquote, says Jowers' attorney Lewis Garrison, Mr. Jowers will say that immediately after the shot was fired from the bushes, a Memphis police officer, who had been his hunting companion on many trips, either threw or gave him a gun which was still smoking, unquote. Jowers recently told his story to King's son Dexter and the Reverend Andrew Young. Shortly before the assassination, he says, five men came to his grill, including two Memphis cops he knew. Jowers was promised a substantial sum if he received a package and passed it along to someone else. He opened the package when it arrived. found a rifle inside, and stashed it in a back room until another man came to pick it up on the day before the assassination. Jowers was also instructed to be standing outside his back door the next night at 6 p.m. That's when he was handed the still-smoking gun, wiped it down with a towel, and hid it temporarily in his shop. The money he received, Jowers claimed, came from a Memphis produce dealer with connections to the New Orleans mob. His story gains corroboration from John McFerrin, a gas and grocery store owner who'd been shopping at the same produce place on the afternoon of the assassination. McFerrin, McFerren, told the 1998 conference that he overheard the store owner saying into a telephone, quote, "I told you not to call me here. Shoot the son of a bitch when he comes on the balcony. You go to my brother in New Orleans and get your $5,000 and don't bring your damn A-blank-blank near my place," unquote. Originally, the motel room slated for Dr. King was not located on the balcony but in the courtyard. But, says Ray attorney William Pepper, quote, "Someone appeared who indicated representation of Dr. King and the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and said he must have an open room on the balcony from which he could overlook the swimming pool, which was empty at that time of year anyway. Lorraine Bailey, the motel's owner, complied and made the switch," unquote. Immediately after the assassination, Bailey suffered a stroke from which she never recovered. Judge Brown believes this is what probably transpired, quote, "Somebody at the motel, who was closely privy to the comings and goings of Dr. King, made a call and notified whoever was the sniper that Dr. King was shortly coming out on the balcony," unquote. High-level complicity seems to have been the order of the day. The director of both the Memphis Police Force and fire departments at the time was Frank Holloman, a retired FBI agent who'd supervised Director J. Edgar Hoover's office in Washington. "What are we looking at here?" asks Judge Brown. "You had a director of the FBI with a pathological hatred of Dr. King. A lot of things were buried because everybody trusted Hoover and the FBI 30 years ago, and nobody questioned the lackadaisical, disgustingly inept work that they had in this case," unquote. James Earl Ray, who had escaped from a Missouri penitentiary in 1967, was undeniably in Memphis the following April 4th, but he then somehow made it to Toronto, to England, to Portugal, and back to London again before he was apprehended, successfully eluding his supposed pursuers for 2 months. "You want to say," remarks Judge Brown, again quoting, "that a three-time loser, an escaped convict with no obvious financial resources and no technical knowledge, is going to not only miraculously learn how to become a good marksman, this one individual is able to acquire the resources to get identities of deceased individuals, come up with very good forgeries of passports, and fake identification, and somehow acquire funds for a very expensive itinerary and travel schedule. Then, he gets himself caught because he goes through Heathrow Airport, but does not know whether he is a citizen, an alien, or has Commonwealth status. Now be real. You have to be the worst culpable moron to go for that story. An analysis suggests that what you've got in this case was a stooge whose task was to throw everybody off the trail," unquote. Ray did plead guilty to the crime in 1969 under what he soon afterward says was considerable pressure, and then, after a hasty conviction, recanted his confession. He maintained for years thereafter that he'd been set up by a Latino gunrunner he'd known only as Raul, unquote. Among other things, Ray said that Raul had accompanied him when he purchased a high-powered rifle 5 days before the assassination. Raul then instructed him to take the weapon to Memphis, where Ray handed it over to someone and never saw Raul again. Last March, retired FBI agent Donald Wilson came forward asserting that he was among a team which searched Ray's abandoned Mustang found at the Atlanta Housing Project 6 days after the assassination, or found at an Atlanta Housing Project 6 days after the assassination. "Inside it," said Wilson, "he found two pieces of paper bearing the name Raul, one of which also contained a laundry list of payments to other people and other entities," unquote. The FBI quickly responded that, although Wilson had worked in the Atlanta office at the time, he was not among the vehicle search team and was creating a, quote, total fabrication, unquote. Wilson responded at the Memphis conference that he, quote, would testify under oath anywhere. These documents can be authenticated. I recovered them, and I didn't turn them in because the Bureau was a racist organization from top to bottom, unquote. John Billings, a private investigator for Pepper's legal team, says that Raul was ultimately traced to suburban New York. Quote, "We had five separate identifications of him," unquote, says Attorney Pepper, "by individuals who were certain he's the right man," unquote. One was Ray himself, who was anonymously sent a photo of this Raul in 1994. Another was Lloyd Jowers, who recalled this person once coming to his grill. Gerald Posner, whose 1993 case closed, tried to prove that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy single-handedly, suggests in Killing the Dream that Martin Luther King's assassination may have involved a, quote, kitchen conspiracy among James Earl Ray and his brothers John and Jerry, the same scenario espoused by the Memphis District Attorney General's office. It's typical Posner, says Professor Philip Melanson, an expert on the King case, again quoting, "You look at the pyramids of his, quote, new discoveries," unquote, "and it's all based pretty much on the official record," unquote. At the April conference in Memphis, Jerry Ray confronted Posner at a local bookstore and says he, quote, "pointed out all the lies about me and other family members," unquote. Indisputably, Judge Brown's dismissal from the official investigation of Dr. King's assassination shows that somebody has something to hide, unquote. Judge Brown didn't always agree to rule with us, and he was very critical of Ray at various times, unquote, says Pepper. But he wanted to get at the truth and open up doors that have long been closed, unquote. Brown pulls no punches about his defenestration from the case. Quote, "The conduct of the Attorney General's office in this case is highly unusual. They had a direct committee formed at taxpayer expense, supposedly to conduct an investigation that resulted in this report they've released. Well, I don't know what it had to do with any investigation. But a lot of their activities had to do with following the judge, that is, Brown himself, videotaping the judge coming out of restaurants, and with his associates, sending individuals to attempt to contact the judge and place him in compromising situations," unquote. The Court of Criminal Appeals that ousted Brown included, the judge says, quote, "former prosecutors involved in the James Earl Ray case who had sat on or were sitting on that bench," unquote. They accused Brown of being too involved in personally grilling witnesses, though the Tennessee Rules of Evidence explicitly allow that. Brown also castigates the Memphis Attorney General's office for, quote, "engaging in a national campaign of slander against the King family. Some reporters have called me up and let me hear tapes they made of comments by members of that office. It's disgusting. It's revolting. It's a defamation of character." The same group that runs around saying a victim's family has an absolute right to be heard, says Judge Brown, doesn't want Coretta Scott King or Dexter King to have a right to say anything, unquote. Last April, however, King's widow met personally with U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno, asking for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to look at, quote, all new and unexamined evidence, unquote, in the case. In August, Reno quietly reopened it. Many say it'll be a moot point. After all, the House Select Committee on Assassinations concurred with the FBI in 1979, proclaiming Ray the assassin. His death ends any hope for a new trial. Still, Judge Brown insists, quote, "the federal government ought to do an investigation. It's obvious from looking at everything in the existing case file. This matter is not resolved. The reason we must go forward is for the children. Generation X is coming of age, and there's going to be leadership which will come out of this generation and the one behind it. They will do things to offend the power structure, just like we did in the 1960s. To protect this new generation from this type of response by the system, we must do something profound so that somebody is brought to justice as a deterrent. A demand needs to be made as to why this farce has been perpetrated among the people," Brown goes on, again quoting, "I'm probably going to catch all kinds of hell for these remarks, but I really don't care that much about being a judge. If I've got to sit there and keep my mouth shut when I see this kind of injustice, they can take this job and shove it," unquote. Again, that article is from High Times Magazine's issue of March of 1999, and it's authored by Dick Russell, the author of the landmark book The Man Who Knew Too Much, arguably the best and certainly the longest book about the assassination of President Kennedy. By the way, there's an interview with Dick Russell that's available from Spitfire. During the course of this broadcast, you heard numerous references to various tapes, half-hour segments, and archive shows. Those are all available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can reach Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. Once again, the regular mailing address for Spitfire is Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. Listeners have been having some trouble accessing the KFJC website. We have changed web servers, and the website is being rebuilt. Happily, I can now report in early February, specifically on February 7th, 1999, that the vast bulk of the For the Record segments are now up on the KFJC webpage. They're up through FTR 116, and that leaves about maybe another 2 to 3 months worth of programming to get up there. That will be up presently. Suffice it to say, the FTR segments, the For the Record segments, basically pretty much everything I've done since 1995, are now numbered and entirely cross-referenced, and very happily they are now up on the KFJC website. Some listeners have been having trouble accessing that website. We have changed web servers, so listeners who have bookmarked that site are going to have to change their bookmark, okay? The website is at www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org, and look in the public affairs section for Spitfire or Dave Emery. And now the vast bulk of the tapes that are available from Spitfire are now, you can now see descriptions of those on the KFJC website. Also, those of you who are equipped to do so can listen to the programs at www.kfjc.org. I'm on the air from 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday night and 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time on Thursday evening. That's 7 to 10 on Sunday night, 6 to 7 on Thursday night Pacific Time, and again, that's www.kfjc.org. And now I'm happy to report that the vast bulk of the segments that are available from Spitfire are on the KFJC website. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.